Today we're going to learn a few ideas about Jewish law for non-Jews. The objective, the point of the class is not to be so much into details of laws, even though we're going to learn laws at the end, like a very simple and clear message. However, my objective is actually to learn and to see how our sages understand how should we or we should not learn laws from the Torah for non-Jews. That's the point we're going to see. So I'm basing my class in a few different sources. I'll try to quote the sources so you can actually check them yourself. And not so much for the checking whether I'm saying the truth or not. That's not so much the point, even though you can do that, no problem. I have nothing to hide. However, the point is there are more details in those sources. There's more information over there, which is interesting in itself. And we can, as you want, we can actually dedicate one class or two classes, whatever, to analyze just a few of the sources, or even a few classes for a few sources, to go into more details in what they say. So let's start. First of all, I'm going to present like disconnected ideas that we will see, with God's help, throughout the class, we will connect these ideas and you will see why I presented them before. First of all, let's start. One place in the Talmud says, actually, before saying this, the Talmud is like a huge, I would say even infinite, like a sea. So there are so many creatures and so many different climates and things and types of water and colors of water, like throughout the seas, it's so difficult and so big. So I'm just bringing a few drops out of this huge sea. That each one of these drops has to be understood in its place, in its context, and so on. And that's the objective of this class, actually. One place in the Talmud says, we don't learn from before the giving of the Torah. Like, what does it mean? Even if we saw a specific thing, story, as we will analyze later, happening before the giving of the Torah, Parshas Yisro, Yitro, Hashem gives the Torah to the Jewish people, which has a whole big meaning in general in Judaism, for Jews and for non-Jews, and the Rambam brings this also for non-Jews, interestingly. But if we see something happening before that, the giving of the Torah, that does not mean that we can learn a law from there. Not necessarily. Yeah, but we saw this guy or that guy, Noach or Shem or whatever name you want to name, behaving and doing something. Is that a law for everybody? The answer is no. Not necessarily. You will see later why I'm bringing this. Second point, very similar to the previous one. The Torah was given at Mount Sinai to the Jewish people, and then law was renewed. That means law itself, and I stress this word, law, and not behavior, as we will see later, law starts, Jewish law starts at the giving of the Torah. Again, even if we see somebody, some character, whatever, behaving in a specific way, that doesn't mean that the law is going to be that way. No way. Why? Because when the Torah was given, law starts anew, so to speak. Let's erase whatever we had, delete it, all the pages, everything in blank, and let's start again. Phrase number three, idea number three. The forefathers, Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, their descendants, and so on, they kept all the Torah and the mitzvahs. I don't know, and I haven't seen written anywhere, what's the text they actually learned. It is actually brought down that Abraham learned Torah with Noach, Yaakov learned Torah with Shem, the son of Noach, but nobody knows exactly what they learned, like the text. Show me the text that they learned. We don't have this. What we know is that they learned whatever they learned, and they, furthermore, not just learned, they kept every single mitzvah, every single commandment that the Jews have nowadays, after the giving of Torah, that's what I mean nowadays. Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, their descendants, they kept them also. They were not obligated, as we will see later, but they kept them also, the whole Torah. And actually interesting, the Alter Rebbe brings even the rabbinical laws, what in the future to them, in the future will be rabbinical ideas and laws and so on, decrees, they kept them also, even before the giving of the Torah, even before the idea of the rabbis saying something even existed, they kept them also. Okay. Last phrase, which is the most complicated one in understanding. And the Talmud, believe me, has a whole discussion of this, pretty complicated and interesting and complicated discussion. Any mitzvah, any commandment that was said, given, stated, whatever, to the Bnei Noach, that means to non-Jews, before the Torah was given, and was repeated at Sinai. So God, so to speak, repeated this commandment, because he said it before in the Torah, but repeated at the giving of the Torah. That means that that particular commandment was stated for this and that group. That means that law applies for Jews and for non-Jews. But if the commandment was only said for non-Jews and was not repeated on Mount Sinai, that means it was said just for Israel, just for the Jews. Hey, but it was said for non-Jews. Yeah, but the truth is, it applies only for Jews. And again, the Talmud discusses this and goes back and forth, different ideas and questions and commandments and so on. These are the ideas of the Talmud. We will base, God willing, the whole class, the whole rest of the class. So having these ideas in mind, let's move on to story number one. We're going to see two stories and more side, so to speak, stories to this that I'm quoting. Story number one. Yaakov got married. Actually, the second story is pretty related to this. Yaakov got married, very, very good, very nice. And he was actually deceived. He first got married to Leah instead of Rachel. He wanted to get married to Rachel. This is Parshas Vayetze. You have to go learn the Torah, whatever. I'm not going to say the whole story. Yaakov, I assume that you learned the stories before. Yaakov got married to Leah. He wanted to get married to Rachel. And he went to complain to his father-in-law, Laban. Why did you deceive me, as we're going to learn later? And Laban, whatever, told him something, you know, we don't do this here, over here, whatever. You want to get married to Rachel also? No problem. Work for 7 years. Which, actually, Yaakov did. He worked for 7 more years. After working 7 years for Rachel, quote-unquote, he got married to Leah, and now he worked another 7 years for Rachel. However, the truth is, if you see in the text, you will find that this is the proper way of reading. He actually waited 1 week after marrying Leah. He married Rachel 1 week after marrying Leah. And then he worked for 7 years. That's the proper order, so to speak, of the story. So in 2 weeks, basically, he got married with two girls, two sisters, actually. Now, from this story, that Yaakov got married to two girls, so to speak, 1 week apart, one apart from the other, we learn actually two things. And I was pretty specific of putting what kind of thing we learn. First of all, we learn a law, a Jewish law, that a bride and a groom, that when they get married, they have to spend a whole week, 7 days, being happy together, knowing each other, and enjoying with each other, and so on. 1 week, they're treated like kings and queens and so on. Very nice week, very, very worked out week. It's a difficult week for the bride and the groom. They go to eat one way and one place, and they go to eat another place. It's a whole, in Hebrew we say balagan, it's a whole mess, but whatever. They're supposed to be happy for 1 week. Where do you get it from? From Yaakov. You see, he married Leah, then he spent a whole week being happy, to quote unquote, with Leah, and then he got married to Rachel. Very nice. It's a law. And we do this. The Jews do this. Second idea, soul attribute. You will see why I'm bringing it this way in a second. We don't mix happiness with happiness. What happened over there? Yaakov wanted to get married to Rachel. He got deceived and he married to Leah. Okay, but I want Rachel, so give me Rachel. Laban, the father of Rachel and Leah, could have said, okay, no problem. Get married to Rachel also, of course, work for another 7 years, but whatever, here's the girl, take it away. However, Laban didn't do that, and he said, now wait a second, it's not correct, this is not the proper way of doing things, wait for a whole week, and then you will get married to Rachel. Why? Because we don't mix happiness with happiness. In order to understand a little bit better this principle, I'll tell you a story, a different story, not the ones we're learning over here, a different story from a Rebbe, not a Chabad Rebbe. He was called Rebbe Meir Premishlan. Premishlan, it's a city over there, whatever, in Ukraine or somewhere over there, south of Russia, Ukraine. Rebbe Meir of Premishlan. Rebbe Meir of Premishlan was a very huge rabbi, 1800s, mid-1800s, and it came a time of Simchas Torah. Simchas Torah means one of the most happy and joyful times in the Jewish calendar. People dance and happy and, okay, very interesting Yom Tov festivity in itself. But the daughter of Rav Meir of Premishlan was very sick. And I mean, so sick, the doctors would say, she's about to die. There's nothing else we can do. She's very, very sick. Nothing to do about it. And the Hasidim, the followers of Rav Meir, were so worried what's going to happen with the daughter of the Rebbe and the Rebbe himself and Simchas Torah coming and what's going to happen? We don't know. We don't know. So, okay, Simchas Torah came. The daughter was very sick and the Rebbe was dancing and dancing and dancing and so happy. And he was so happy and dancing and dancing and dancing. And the Hasidim didn't really understand. So whatever, they danced also. And at some point, one of the close members of the family came to the Rebbe and said, Rebbe, your daughter is really, really, these are the last moments. It's over. These are really, really the last moments. So please come say something to her, like look at her, whatever. So the Rebbe stopped the dancing and the Rebbe looked up to the heavens. I don't remember the exact words, but the Rebbe said something like this. Rebbe Meir said like this. Ribbono shel Olam, master of the world. Master of the world, I have a problem. I have a problem. When you said we had to blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah, Rav Meir, that means himself, Rav Meir blew the shofar. When you said we have to fast in Yom Kippur, Rav Meir fasted. When you said we have to be happy on Sukkos, so I was happy, Rav Meir was happy. He used to talk like that, like Rav Meir this and Rav Meir that. He didn't talk about himself. And now came Simchas Torah. And you said we have to be happy in Simchas Torah. So Rav Meir is happy. I'm dancing and dancing. I'm happy, but I have a problem. You said also that we have to be happy with the sufferings we have. We have to receive our problems and sufferings, like real sufferings, with joy. I have a problem. We don't mix joy with joy. The joy of Simchas Torah and the joy of my daughter passing away right now. I have to be in joy. So I'm so happy. I can't be happy for both things at the same time. You don't mix happiness with happiness. So please, help me. And at that second, the daughter of Rav Meir got completely healed. So he would be able to be happy on Simchas Torah and not be happy with his daughter passing away, basically. So we see that there's such a thing as not mixing happiness with happiness. And the problem is, again, that happiness, it's a feeling in the heart. It's not a law. I can tell you, yeah, you have to be happy. If there's Hashem B'simcha, we have to serve God with happiness, joy. It's true. But the truth is that it's something that happens in your heart. Whether you're happy or not happy, it's a difficult thing to turn over like in a second. Yeah, start being happy. Yeah. It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work so easy like that. So we do learn this idea, soul attribute of being happiness, of being happy, I'm sorry, joyful, and not mixing one joy with another joy from the story of Yaakov. Why? Why do we learn this? If we said before, we don't learn from before the Torah to after the Torah. Why? Because this is an attribute in the soul. The nature of a human being is when you're happy with one thing, It's not so easy to say, okay, I'm going to be happy with a different thing. You're still thinking about the previous one that you were happy with. So that's why the 7 days of happiness, we really don't learn them from Yaakov, because it's a law. But the idea of not mixing one joyful moment with another one, we do learn from Yaakov, even though it was before the giving of the Torah, because what we're learning is an attribute of the soul. Something that happens in the nature of a human being, not so much something you have to go and do or not to do and so on. So I have to, it has to be clear the difference between a law, something that comes, so to speak, from God, go do this and don't do that and so on, or a behavior. We saw Yaakov saying, or actually Laban saying to Yaakov, we cannot mix Leah with the joy of Rachel. So separate them by a week. If a week passed by, so you're going to be able to focus on Rachel properly. And Yaakov said, yes, you're right. This is a human thing. So when we see before the giving of the Torah, in the Torah, when we see stories or ideas, attitudes that teach us behaviors of the regular human being, yeah, that we learn from before the giving of the Torah. Like to be kindful. Yeah, be a kind person like Avraham. He too used to be a kind person. That we can learn. But not as an obligation and a law of being kind because Avraham was kind. No. Wait a second. Laws? There's a giving of the Torah over here. And when the Torah was given, the law was renewed completely. So you want to learn law? Look at the Torah from the giving of the Torah on. You want to learn behaviors like a regular or good, so to speak, forefathers were good people. So good human beings, you can learn behaviors from even before the giving of the Torah, but never to say it's an obligation. No, it's a behavior, not necessarily obligation, that expresses the nature of a human being. This is story number one, to start understanding how do we learn laws from the Torah for today, for non-Jews. Because if you want to learn for Jews, just pick up the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, and look what the laws are, and that's it. It's quite easy, so to speak. It's not easy to fulfill it, but whatever. If you want to know what it is, just look at the book, ask a rabbi, and the rabbi is going to tell you. But for non-Jews, it becomes a little bit more difficult. And we tend to look at the Torah and say, yeah, look, he did like this. I'm supposed to be doing this. Not necessarily. If it's a law, no. If it's a behavior, maybe yes. But not obligated. Okay, let's move on. Why does it work like that? Why is it like that? The Rebbe has a sicha, I mentioned it before over here. This is the source that I'm teaching from, so to speak. The forefathers, even though they served God to the best way they could, and they kept the whole Torah, everything very nice. However, they served them because of own motivation, like from below to above. They decided to serve God. And this piece of information is going to be important for later. They decided to serve God. And with prophecy or whatever, they knew what God would tell the Jewish people later. And they decided, later means after the giving of the Torah, and they decided to serve God that way. But that doesn't mean they were obligated. No way. No way. And that doesn't mean we can learn from that to every single human being in the face of the earth. That is a non-Jew, no way, not necessarily. They reached the highest of the highest levels like every single creature could ever reach, yes. However, whatever they did not have the same effect a Jew has when he does it after the giving of the Torah. So let's suppose, there's another story about Yaakov. Yaakov, when he was multiplying the sheep of Laban to make his own sheep and so on, his own money, he made some sticks, white sticks and with marks and so on. And the Zohar says that he, with those sticks, I mentioned this before in a different class also, Yaakov with those sticks, he kept the mitzvah of tefillin, whatever that means, the mitzvah of tefillin. Today, the mitzvah of tefillin is not with sticks, it's with boxes, black box in the head, a black box in the arm. It's not with sticks. And Yaakov, after finishing with the sticks, he just threw the sticks away. And we don't throw the tefillin away, even though we don't throw them because they're very expensive. But the truth is, we don't throw them because it's a holy, holy item. We don't throw them. Even if the tefillin, for some reason, fall in the air, in the ground, in the floor, you have to fast the whole day. So we're very careful with the tefillin. Not to throw them, not to this and that, and so on. So what's the difference that before the giving of the Torah, that's the turning point. I mentioned it so many times. So before Yaakov threw away the sticks, even though he was fulfilling the mitzvah of tefillin. And today we're so careful with the tefillin. Why? And the answer is because before the giving of the Torah, there was a decree that the north, quote unquote, the spiritual world, they're not imbue the physical world, and the physical world was not able to go up to the spiritual world, and therefore there was a cut in the middle, and that feeling that Yaakov actually fulfilled, whatever that means, with the sticks, did not really bring down holiness, Kedusha, in the sticks. So the sticks were just a stick, whatever, a piece of wood, and he threw them away. But today, after the Gimel Torah, what the whole subject of the Gimel Torah is to destroy that decree that the north could come to the south. That's the way it's mentioned in the Midrashim by our sages. The spiritual world can come down to the physical world. The physical world can go up to the spiritual world. And that's why with the tefillin, when a Jew actually uses the tefillin, he brings down a kedusha, a holiness in that object, in the physical object. And therefore has to be taken care with and so on. Now, that's about the laws. Because God comes and says, that's the difference. God comes and says, you should do this and that. Tefillin, for instance. Before, the first thing I wrote is Avram. Let's take Avram or Yaakov or whomever. Serve God from below to above. I decided to serve God in this way. But after the giving of the Torah, God says, I want you from below, from above to below, I want you to serve me in this particular way. So it comes from above to below. And therefore, when it's a law that comes from above to below, God is the one giving us the laws and saying, you should do this and you should not do that and so on. When it comes to a law, you cannot learn law from before the giving of the Torah. Even if the people before the giving of the Torah were not Jews, that it's a whole big, believe me, big discussion in law, whether Abraham was a Jew or not another Jew and so on. We're not getting into that discussion because it's too long and complicated. But even if you want to say they were not Jews and they behaved in a specific way, you cannot learn from their behaviors laws for today for the non-Jews. No. However, behaviors you can learn. Why? So the Rebbe brings, I wrote it as easier as I could. The Rebbe brings the explanation for this. Why can we learn behaviors from before the giving of Torah to after the giving of Torah? Because basically it was a behavior what actually generated the situation, circumstances we live today. By man eating from the fruit of the tree he was not supposed to be eating and so on, he generated the world we live in today. He generated the whole idea of Jews and non-Jews, which is a whole subject in itself also. But having said that, since it was a behavior, not a law specifically, a behavior of the first man and people after him, like Cain killing Hevel and so on, since it was a behavior, therefore, our behaviors can fix retroactively, so to speak, towards the past, the behaviors they actually did. That's why we can learn behaviors from before the giving of the Torah and apply them to today. Of course, if you're going to learn the bad behaviors, you're not in a good shape. Learn the good behaviors, because those good behaviors are the things that actually fix their bad behavior. Our good behavior learned from the behaviors of the people before the giving of the Torah are actually a way of fixing, correcting the behaviors of the people before the giving of the Torah. That's why we can learn behaviors, but not necessarily laws. Okay, step number one. Now let's go to step number two, very related to what we said before. Yaakov's marriage. He married two sisters, Leah and Rachel. Besides the whole thing that we discussed before about the week and so on, there's another problem over here. We said that the forefathers used to keep the whole Torah even before it was given. So Yaakov also, he was a forefather and he kept the Torah before the Torah was given. And there's a law in the Torah for Jews, even applying today also, that it is forbidden to marry two sisters. You can't. So how come Yaakov married two sisters? Why did he marry two sisters? He was not allowed. So there are a few answers. I present over here three answers that are brought down by the Rebbe in this particular source, Likutei Sichos. But the Rebbe actually is not satisfied with any of the answers, and he brings a fourth, so to speak, answer, which is the one that I actually want to teach. But before, let's see if others thought about this question, which actually is a famous question. So first answer is the Ramban, Nachmanides, he lived in Spain. So Nachmanides says something interesting. I don't know what the source of Nachmanides is, but for us, he's enough of a source. He says that the forefathers only kept the Torah inside the land of Israel. Outside the land of Israel, they did not keep the Torah. And Yaakov was in Haran. Haran is some place in Syria today. So he was not obligated to keep the Torah. That's why he married two sisters. No problem. If he would be in Eretz Israel, it's a problem. He can't. Of course, after he came back, okay, I'm already married. What do you want from me? To divorce? Okay, whatever. He didn't divorce. But he married outside of Eretz Israel. That's what the Ramban says. Then you have the Precious Drachim. This book actually discusses a long and complicated discussion whether the forefathers were Jews, regular non-Jews, or Bnei Noach. It's a whole long, long, long discussion. So he brings that God told Yaakov to marry them. That's it. Where do you see this from? I don't know. Where he got it from? I have no idea. Okay, he was a huge rabbi, important, whatever. But this is what it says. God told him, so Yaakov said, okay, I want to keep the Torah, but God is telling me something else with prophecies. I'm going to do whatever God says. No problem. And the Rebbe himself, even though he gives a fourth answer, what I'm going to teach you in a second, he gives a different answer in a note, very brief, a very interesting answer. The reason for the prohibition is that you cannot marry two sisters. Why not? Because they're going to fight all the time. It's my husband, it's my husband. You took my husband, now it's my husband, whatever. I got married first, you know, I'm prettier than you, I'm wiser than you, whatever. They're going to fight all the time. And actually, interestingly, the relationship between two wives of the same man has a name in the Torah. You know, all relationships is my father, my daughter, my wife, whatever, it has a name. My wife, yeah, the woman that is with me is my wife, and so on. What's the name for the relationship between two wives of the same man? Today, as far as I know, in Spanish, we don't have a name for this. I don't think in English we have a name for this either, but whatever, maybe some language has. I don't know, Arabs, maybe, whatever. So in Hebrew, there's a name. The name is Tzara. That's the name. So this girl is a Tzara to this girl. The relationship between them, what is? We're married to the same man. Okay, well, you know what? What Tzara means in Hebrew? Suffering. That's what it means. Tzara means a suffering. They hated each other. You took my husband. Now you took my, I'm younger than you. That's why he loves me. You're an old girl. They fought all the time. It was a terrible life. I don't know why a person would marry more than one woman. They fought all the time. It's a Tzara. It's a suffering between them and for the husband. Stop fighting and so on. Now, that's the reason for the prohibition. That's wrote down in the books, whatever. There's no reasons for the mitzvahs, for the commandments. That's what is brought down. There's a prohibition of marrying two sisters. Why? Because they fought all the time. But you know what? The Rebbe brings in a note. Rochel and Leah and Rochel, they were two tzadkanias. They were so righteous women, and they loved each other. How do you know that? Because Rochel when she saw that Leah was brought in, to the chuppah, to the nuptial, whatever thing, to get married, out of love, and so that her sister would not be embarrassed, she passed them some signs. So when Yaakov asked, what's the sign for, blah, 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 so Leah knew what to answer, so Yaakov didn't realize it was Leah instead of Rochel. So that's an act of love, of kindness, of one sister, Rochel, toward another sister, Leah. So we see that this reason of not marrying two sisters did not apply to Leah and Rochel, Rochel and Leah. That's why Yaakov married two sisters, no problem. They're not going to fight all the time. That's what the Rebbe brings in a note. But that's not the real, like, deep, so to speak, answer. The Rebbe brings another answer. But before understanding the answer the Rebbe brings, let's analyze another idea brought down in a few places by Rashi. And he takes it from the Midrash. from the works of our sages, of course, but interesting to know that regarding the story of Dina, again, I'm not going to tell all the whole story, it's going to be too long. So the story is Dina was raped by Shechem, abducted by Shechem. It's a whole story. I'm not going to the whole story, but what was wrong with it? Like, Dina was not married. She was not a married woman. And whatever, she got married with Shechem. It wasn't such a happy and joyful marriage, but whatever. What's the problem with Shechem? What was wrong with what he did? So our sages explain, Rashi brings it in his commentary to the Torah, that the nations fenced themselves against raping virgins. Dina was a virgin, and she was a young girl, and here comes Shechem, and whatever, Shechem wants to, quote-unquote, get married. Afterwards, he wanted to get married, but whatever. Let's call it like that way. Just talking a clean language. Whatever. So what's the problem? And the problem is, everybody, like the nations themselves, they agreed that they would not do this. They wouldn't do this. There was nothing written, no law written by God or given by God or anything like that. The nations agreed, we're not going to do this after the flood, because that was one of the things that used to happen before the flood. So God brought a whole flood, he killed everybody. So okay, we're not doing this anymore. Abducting and raping and so on. We're not doing this anymore. And Shechem, for whatever reason, he did not keep this particular law. But we see that there were laws that everybody, it wasn't such a quote-unquote big world, not everybody, whatever, they were quite together and not so many people as today. But everybody agreed on this. They had some system of laws, even though they were not God-given laws and not written laws, but they had some system of laws. We see another story by Avraham Avinu, and by Yaakov says the same story, basically. Avraham left his father. He was an old man, Terach. But the Torah says, by the end of Parshas Noach, that Terach passed away. Terach passed away. And then the Torah continues saying, Avraham left. And he went, Avraham was 75 years old. The truth is, Terach was still alive. But the previous verse, the end of Parshas Noach, says Terach passed away. The beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha says, Avraham left his house. It sounds like, okay, my father passed away, I'm just going, whatever, I'm traveling. God told me to travel, whatever, doesn't matter. You're traveling, it sounds good. But the truth is that Terach was alive. And Avraham anyway left. Wait a second, ask our sages. Avraham left his father, an old man, and he did not honor his father? Like, help him, he's an old man. So that's why the Torah chooses to write, Terach passed away, even though he didn't pass away. And if you look at Rashi, Rashi explains the whole numbers, all the numbers over there. I'm not going into the details, but the point is that people used to say, you have to honor your parents. It's something natural to the person. Your parents, of course, gave you life, gave you education, gave you food, clothes, and everything you need. So the last thing you can do is to honor them. So that's why the Torah writes, Terach passed away, Avraham left. Oh, nobody's going to say he didn't honor his father. And the same thing happens by Yaakov, not honoring his father Yitzchak, which is a very old man. And Yaakov, whatever, left, and he spent 20 years by Laban, not honoring his father. The Torah talks about it also. And another idea, I mean, again, this was not a written law by honoring parents. It was not a written law, a godly law, and so on. There was no such a thing. But people are anyway kept this. So we see that there's something natural to people, or there's something natural to society. We all agree on this. Okay, let's keep this. Like by Dina, and not raping and so on. And the same thing happens with Yaakov. Yaakov complains to Laban, Lama remisani, why did you deceive me? Hey, come on, people don't behave like this. Yaakov was like surprised. Why did you deceive me? Why was he so surprised? Laban was called Laban Harami. He came from Aram, whatever, someplace in Syria. But if you play a little bit with the letters of the word Arami, he was a Ramoi. He was a deceiver. That's what Laban was. He lived on deceiving people. However, Yaakov was surprised. Why was he so surprised? Because, again, people agreed on not deceiving others. We don't deceive. It's impossible to have a society if you deceive people. So let's agree. We're not going to lie. We're not going to deceive people. So Yaakov was surprised. Why did you deceive me? And Laban gave a whole explanation of it. Ah, we don't do this over here to give the older daughter, the younger daughter before the older daughter. We don't do this over here. That's a whole lie. Another lie. You keep on lying. Why? Yaakov was surprised. So we see that there are certain behaviors. We can, again, I stress this word, behaviors, not laws, behaviors. We can learn from before the giving of the Torah to apply after the giving of the Torah for non-Jews. With this information, we're going to understand a little bit better why Yaakov got married to Rachel after marrying Leah, that were two sisters, even though he kept the whole Torah. What does it mean that Yaakov kept the whole Torah, or our forefathers, it's the same reason, the same idea. The truth is, he was not obligated to fulfill the Torah. He just took it upon himself, as in Hebrew we call it a chumra. Chumra means you're strict upon yourself. I'm going to behave in a more strict way. Am I obligated? No, but I decided to behave this way, but not as an obligation. Now, if Yaakov would keep his behavior of being strict, of not marrying two sisters, because the Torah will say in so many years from now that a Jew cannot marry two sisters, he's going to have a problem. He promised Rachel to marry her. When they saw each other, even before Yaakov knew Leah and Laban and the whole family, he already encountered Rachel in Parshas Vayetze, and he gave her even a kiss, and whatever, they promised, we're going to get married. We're one for each other. You're for me, I'm for you. And suddenly over here, for whatever reason, quote-unquote, Laban and deceiving and so on, Yaakov is married to Leah. Suddenly he's married to Leah. What do I do now? If I want to keep my, quote-unquote, strictness, my laws, my being strict with myself is going to harm somebody else. It's going to harm Rachel. And I'm going to be deceiving Rachel, lying, so to speak, to Rachel by not marrying her because I'm strict with myself. So over here, there's an amazing lesson for every single person in the world. It works better with the relationship between parents and children, or between husband and wife. By me being strict on myself, I have to be very careful not to harm anybody else. Wait a second. Analyze the world around you. You want to keep this, you want to see this, and you want to do this, and blah, blah, blah. Is it going to hurt somebody else? Be careful. If we're talking about something you're obligated on doing, okay. So the Torah says, God obligates, whatever. So we do it. The law obligates, let's call it like that. So we have to do it, whether you like it or not, we have to do it. But it's just because I want to be more, quote unquote, religious. I want to be more religious. I want to connect to God and godliness and then blah, blah, blah. And suddenly people get hurt because you want to be more religious? I think you have a problem. Big problem. So that's why, this is the way the Rebbe explains, that's why, actually, Yaakov got married to Rachel after marrying Leah. Not to deceive Rachel. On the basis of this, we learn something very interesting that the Rebbe brings about the role of non-Jews in the world. What's the Torah expecting of them? Okay, seven laws, I know, not to kill, not to steal, not to murder, not to eat from a living animal, and then not to do idolatry, and not to blaspheme, or whatever. Yeah, very nice. And not to do injustice, not to be unrighteous, or whatever the way you say it. Very nice. Is there anything else? Oh, yes. It's a whole world over there. Big world. Really. Why? Because the whole role of non-Jews in the Jewish, so to speak, quote unquote, perspective, world or way of seeing things, is to have a world inhabited with people. That means a righteous, moral, ethical world where people live in peace. That's what the non-Jews are supposed to be doing according to the Jewish ideas, the Jewish religion, so to speak, whatever, to call it in some way. So that means that any behavior that would bring justice to the world, righteousness to the world, morality, and so on, any behavior, whether you see it in the Torah or you don't see it in the Torah, of course, a behavior that you see in the Torah that would bring righteousness to the world, you're supposed to be doing it. Furthermore, you're obligated on doing that. It's not just whether you like it or not. Let's suppose, just take one very small thing, lying. Are you allowed to lie? Okay. For the Jews, you can say it's a verse, Midvar Sheker Tirchak. You have to get away from lies. Okay, so the Jews are obligated not to lie. Whatever, whether it's nice or not, I don't care. What about the non-Jews? There's no such a verse for non-Jews. It is not one of the seven commandments. Where is it written? Maybe non-Jews can lie? Who says no? And the answer is what we just explained. Any behavior, in this case, we learn from Yaakov. He didn't want to deceive or lie, whatever, this basically is an idea, to Rachel. So any behavior that would bring, again, morality, ethical life, and so on to the world, you're obligated to do it. Now, lying, of course, is not an ethical behavior. Like, nobody argues this. So therefore, a non-Jew is not allowed to lie. And this is not something circumscribed just to what I think. I'm the rabbi over here. I think blah, blah, blah. Who cares what you think? You're just supposed to be transmitting what the Torah says, not what you think. So we have to be very careful, very, very careful to know whether a specific behavior is just the rabbi's way of thinking, or really it has a source, so to speak, in the Torah. Regarding the same idea of not lying, of course we can see it is not a proper behavior because God tells the Jews not to lie. If God wouldn't say anything, maybe you can lie. I don't know. But God says clearly to the Jews, don't lie. So that means it is not a behavior God wants. Is a non-Jew allowed to do it? So again, if you're just going to look at the verses, the verse that says don't lie is said to the Jews. So maybe non-Jews can lie? And the answer is no. As a ethical behavior, moral behavior, whatever you want to call it, it's clear that you cannot lie. You have to honor your parents, help your surroundings, tzedakah, call it charity, or whatever you want to call it. So all of these behaviors are also obligations for non-Jews. Regarding tzedakah itself, it's a very interesting discussion between the Rambam, Maimonides, and the Ramban, Nachmanides, whether non-Jews are obligated or not. Okay, it's for a different class, so to speak. But certainly, again, moral and ethical behaviors, that is expected exactly from the non-Jews. Furthermore, very related to this, it's not a different idea, but it's very related to this, all rational behaviors, all behaviors that any society would say, yeah, this is correct, a non-Jew is supposed to be doing it. This is brought down in a few sources that I copied one of the sources, which is very interesting, not so known, but very interesting. Rav Nissim Goyen, he writes a whole long book, it's not a book, it's like an introduction to a book, but a whole long text. And within the text, he says, all rational commandments, so to speak, specifically between men and his fellow men, non-Jews have to be keep it also. And the Ramban says something very similar, very, very similar. Now, this source, I'm going to read it from the Kuzari. It's a very interesting book, long and complicated book, but it brings something so simple. These and similar ones are the rational laws. He's talking to a king of the Khuzars, whatever. He ended up converting. He says, there are rational laws, And they are the precursors on councils of the divine Torah. That means the Torah also brings a lot of rationality, a lot of rational ideas, mainly in the relationship between man and his fellow. And this precedes the Torah in nature and time. That means if you're not a quote unquote good guy, it's very difficult that you will really keep the Torah. Being a quote unquote good guy comes before, and I stress this so much, before in nature to keeping the Torah. It's impossible to keep the Torah if you're not a good guy. And also, says the Kuzari, in time. That means good behavior precedes in time to the giving of the Torah. People were behaving properly before the Torah was given also. Without them, without the rational, moral, and ethical things, it is impossible for any human community to be governed, like to function. It's impossible. And he brings an example, a very interesting example. Until a group of robbers, like really stealing and killing, they don't care about anything. But it's impossible that they don't accept righteousness among themselves. And if not, the group would not last. Like, suppose, a group of robbers. Between themselves, they don't rob each other. They don't kill each other. Otherwise, it's impossible. Like, just work by yourself. It's impossible to have a group if you don't have a set of laws. Like, between us, we're not going to hurt each other. We're not going to steal each other. Okay, let's kill everybody and let's steal everybody. But between us, no. Otherwise, it's impossible. So that means there is rationality in the nature of a human being. That's the word nature over here. And it precedes the Torah in time. That's another source that clearly shows that every single thing, law, idea, behavior, I'm just being vague in the term itself, every single thing we see in the Torah, and even outside the Torah, that's what the Kuzari is saying, outside the Torah, in the nature of human being, that is a good thing for society, you're supposed to be doing it. You're obligated to do it. According to the Torah, you're obligated to do it. In order to have what? Not to be destroyed, not to be a waste. God created the world. To be a very inhabited and with calmness, with joy, with happiness, with peace, and so on. That's why God created the world. And that's why God put a whole bunch of human beings around the whole world to make the whole world this place that can be inhabited and live with peace and with righteousness and joy and so on. So, just as a summary, let's go back just a second to the first, the rulings of the Talmud. Just as a summary to end, we don't learn from before the giving of the Torah. Yeah, why not? Because law was given at the giving of the Torah on. And whatever the Torah says, certain laws will apply to Jews, certain laws will apply to non-Jews. The forefathers kept the whole Torah, yes, but they were not obligated. They were not told by God to keep certain commandments. Actually, for instance, Abraham, our forefather, was told to circumcise. Just one thing. The rest of the Torah he kept, but he wasn't told by God. And then this idea of the mitzvahs that were given before the Torah, after the Torah, repeated, and so on, which is a whole study in itself, that's a framework, so to speak, to decide exactly which laws from the Torah that appear before the giving of the Torah actually apply to non-Jews also. The Talmud over here in Sanhedrin 59 has a whole A and B. Okay, whatever, I put B and B, but A and B. The Talmud has a whole discussion about it, pretty interesting to learn it by itself.